Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of Entrepreneur on Fire. Jeff, could you maybe laugh just a little bit less? Come on, man.
Are you ready to thoughtfully steer away from your revved up, frenzied, and far too often scripted life? Then welcome to Vroom Vroom Veer with Jeff Smith, where he guides you down the road differently traveled by sharing unique experiences with guests who have managed to shift away from a life stuck on cruise control and veered their way into a more authentic and fulfilling one in all sorts of interesting and kind of remarkable ways. Get ready to vroom vroom veer with your differently traveled road chauffeur, Jeff Smith.
Thank you so much for being here and welcome to Vroom Vroom Veer.
It's fun to have a conversation when we're completely separated by a continent, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I'm delighted to be able to do this, man. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
It's like we're living in the future, right?
Yeah, you are. I'm living in the past. You're living in the future.
That's right. It's true. I have these conversations sometimes, like my wife is Japanese. So I visit Japan sometimes, and you are literally living in the future when you're in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents live in Australia right now, and it is the most bizarre thing to have a conversation with them. In fact, I've got an e-course coach right now who lives on the Gold Coast of Australia, and it is the hardest thing. Even after my parents have lived there for 2 years, I'll get on a coaching call with him about 5:30 in the morning my time, and I'm like, have a good weekend or happy Friday. I don't know what to tell you, Tim, but just – you know, whatever you're about to go into in Australia, have fun.
Right. I mean, up is down, north is west. Everything is different in Australia. Yeah. I mean, summer is winter, winter is summer. It's it's wackadoo. Yeah, my dad always gets a kick out of when I explain to him when I'm flying back to Japan. We leave Japan at like 10 a.m. on, you know, say like Monday or something. And then you arrive 2 hours before you left.
Right. And you didn't go backwards.
No. You got all that time back that you lost when you left.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there we go. Talk a little bit about time travel. It was great. So, all right. So your deal is business on purpose, and you like to integrate, mash together your business life and your faith, right?
Yes.
So we're going to get to that. But this is Room from Fear. So let's go back in time. You know, we're going to time travel on the show and talk a little bit about one of those life-changing events, maybe somewhere around the college days. What were your college days like?
My college days, and by the way, the thing that it really intrigued me about your title is I tell people all the time that my blueprint is very non-linear. So when you've got a title of a podcast called Room, Room, Veer, you're immediately intrigued, especially when you've got a blueprint that's as non-linear as mine is. So
there you go.
For me, when I was a freshman in college, I was at the University of South Carolina, and I was a really, really pitiful high school football player. I played 1 year, it was my senior year, in high school, and I was really bad. In fact, I was so bad I had to lobby the head coach at the end of the season after the sports banquet when all of the letters had been doled out. I had to lobby the coach to get a letter.
Wow.
Because I was so bad. I just didn't play that much.
Wow.
But I, you know, told him I was out here. I gave it my all. And he was like, yeah, and all four plays? Yeah, you really gave it your all, buddy.
Hey, but you showed up to all the practices.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was there.
You put in the sweat
running
equity,
and the throwing
right?
up and the whole thing. And so,
yeah. I remember
so anyway,
those, yeah.
We, when I got to college, my freshman year, a couple things happened. One, from a very spiritual standpoint, I had a guy speak at an event called FCA, which is a Fellowship of Christian Athletes, which is quite ironic because I was not an athlete, and yet here I was at this FCA thing. And so I went, and this guy spoke, and I saw a different perspective of faith in Jesus, faith in God, God's Word, the Bible, et cetera, than I had really ever seen before. And I don't know why. I still can't explain it today. Here we are 20 plus years later from when that happened in 93. And so that was a trampoline of sorts for me from a faith perspective. Really started to begin to evaluate, look into, think deeply about faith, particularly faith in Jesus and and work through that. Well, about a month after that, and these were not hinged, I don't think. Maybe they were. I don't know. But about a month after that, football season at the University of South Carolina was just about to wind up, and my college roommate was a manager for the team, which means he was the guy that helped get the uniforms ready and set up cones and do all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he came home one night and said, "Hey, I remember you tried to deep snap in high school and snapping for punters and field goal kickers."
Yeah, right.
And he said, "You know, what's crazy is there's only one deep snapper on the whole team. There's a couple guys, but they don't want to learn how to do it because they're tight ends and other positions, and they just don't want to. They don't want to mess with it."
Right.
"You ought to see if blank, you know, dot dot dot." And I was like, "Yeah, man, that would be super cool. You know, I'm big and robust, and I run a 5'2 flat, and I was 195 pounds at the time. So sure, SEC Division I football team. Why not? Why not do that?
You could do that."
Yeah. And so I was just
naive enough to think you can do that.
I was just freshman enough to think that I could do it.
Exactly, right.
And perfect. So I told my roommate at the time, Wade, I said, "Hey, Wade, can you bring a football home when you come home from, you know, practice one day?" He's like, "Yeah." So he started bringing footballs home every night. And so for every night in the dorm room hallway, which was 16 yards long, a deep snapper snap is 15 yards long. So I only needed that amount.
Okay.
And every night for an hour to 2 hours, I would long snap in the hallway. Long story short, ended up walking onto the football team, ended up never having snapped a football in a live football game, flag, high school, middle school, nothing. And the first snap I ever threw in a live football game was at a small little college in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, named Louisiana State University, LSU. And 80-something thousand people pouring down rain, both of my parents' alma mater, which meant about 30 of my family members were there. And they were all prepped prior to, with my dad saying, "Hey, guys, now listen, you know, Scott's on the team, but he doesn't play. You know, he's just on."
Right.
And it was true.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
I was on the team, didn't play. And so, first punt snap of the game, I look on the field and our first string snapper, Derek Gregory, comes running off and he's got his shoulder hanging out of socket.
Oh,
I thought,
my God.
Huh. All right. Let me think rationally and logically here. So, he's the first string deep snapper. I'm the second string deep snapper. His shoulder is non-functional at this point,
right.
And you really do need those to be able to throw the ball upside down and backwards,
yeah,
15 yards in less than 0.8 seconds.
Yes.
So
you need that arm to work, basically.
You do,
yeah.
Desperately. And so my position coach comes running over to me, and so this is a teachable moment for all of us, all of you who ever coach any kind of sport. And his first statement to me was, "Don't you blank this up." And the blank started with an F. And so I highly recommend all coaches from here on out, please don't ever use that as your approaching statement to a guy who has never, ever played in a live football game in his life.
So that was a gulp. That was a gulp veer.
Yes.
You were gulp.
That's exactly right. So I had to veer from the sideline where I was comfortable, used to it, enjoyed it. I got free food. I got, you know, workout sweats.
Yeah.
I got free travel to and from these beautiful college campuses, mm-hmm, and et cetera. And I had to veer onto the field, and things ended up going great. We ended up beating LSU 18-17.
Wow.
Game for us, and never beat them again, but that's neither here nor there. And so ended up my second year, our first string deep snapper was back, and so I was still second string. And then my third and fourth year ended up earning a full scholarship. And so I actually paid for the last 2 years of my university degree by throwing a football upside down and backwards.
You were, wow. So did you become first string long snapper for your junior and senior year? Wow.
That's right. Those final 2 years, and Derek graduated, and I was fortunate enough to be able to work into that role, and it was just so much fun. But, you know, what was interesting, Jeff, is the learning lessons while you're there, sure, you recognize some of them, but looking back, you continually ask yourself, why did something like that happen to a guy like me? And I can go into the whole stories about effort and blah, blah, blah. And you got to have effort. Don't get me wrong. But at the same time, I mean, some things just kind of fall into place, you know?
Right. Yes.
That, in a same way, kind of helped to rehash the whole faith discussion that I was going into right now in college. And so anyway, those two things at the time didn't seem like they went together, but looking back, you know, 20 plus years later, now you're going, all right, I think these things are weaving together.
Yeah, you know, that was a lesson that I learned about what we call this planning, because I was in the military, right?
Hyper-plan.
Yeah. The military is crazy about planning to the point where, you know, you just whenever you the word plans are like mentioned and you have to be involved, you do everything you can to run away. Right? It's just, I mean, for me, I mean, some people just really, really dig making plans. But usually in the military, that means you have to find the old plan first and then do one of these search replace boilerplate from hell document rewrite, right? That's what you're looking at. Then I later learned after I retired about the value of planning in that, you know, because at the time I'm like, you know, we don't do anything with these plans. They're just stupid.
Right.
You know, you just take the plan, you put it in the file and you show the inspector when he shows up and he says, look, we got a plan. That's, you know, and from the grunt that had to make the plan, it seems like it's totally valueless. Do you know where I'm coming from? You know what I mean?
Sure.
But then later on when I actually became a boss, and I had, you know, other folks making plans on my behalf, and then things went wrong. You've got somewhere to go, because you've got a plan. You've got a plan for everything, right?
Right.
The military, right? And yes, that plan is in many ways pretty useless in and of itself. But the process of going through making it prepared you for the event.
And you know, Jeff, a lot of people will say, I'm in the systems and process business. That's what I do with small business owners. And we'll get to a process and we'll build out the process. And I'll get this glazed look like, why are we doing this? Because the conversation will go something like this. It'll be, hey, you know, we've really been falling down in our job site walks. Let's take a general contractor, for instance. Mm-hmm. We've really been falling down. Our superintendent's not going through the job site walk. And our jobs are being left, you know, dirty, and clients, you know, I mean, these are million-plus-dollar homes. And so clients don't even want their job site dirty, let alone, you know, their beautiful house. And so we'll walk through and I'll say, okay, well, walk me through exactly what you want a job site walk to look like. So step number one, they're like, well, we just want them to clean up. I'm like, no. Let's back up. What should trigger a job site walk? Well, they should be doing it every day. Okay, perfect. So the trigger is
every day.
Daily. The first thing you get out of when you get out of your truck is you initiate this process. And they look at me like, you got to be careful. We're not walking through every step. I'm like, no. We're going to walk through every step of this because we're going to build this thing. But the power, to your point, is not in the building. The power is in the execution, the implementation.
Amen.
Right. And I totally resonate with you on that.
Yeah. It's like showing up to a football game without a game plan. Now, yes, it is incredibly, you know, tiresome to go through that whole process of, you know, being very meticulous and just like, this is what we're going to do, you know, and writing it all down and putting it in a book. And, you know, and because everybody knows as soon as you say hut, the plan more or less is in improvised mode, right?
Yeah.
But because you put in that work, you're prepared to improvise. You can't really improvise without the plan. Does that make sense to you?
There's no doubt. Right. I am 100% on that train.
So it's like this paradox. You know, you really want to improvise, you know, and directors and movies know this intuitively. I've heard Ron Howard talk about it. He'll like prepare. But his favorite thing is just to let the camera roll and hope for magic. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Because you really never know. And it's sometimes you're just trying to capture magic. Right. And that's kind of like what life is like. I mean, the more effort you put into your prep means that it's almost like you're creating, preparation is creating the opportunity to have some sort of luck.
Yeah. Think about pilots. We don't pay pilots to fly planes. It's pretty mundane if you talk to a pilot.
Easy.
What we pay pilots to do is to not crash it when something goes wrong.
Amen.
And same thing with doctors. I mean, if you've ever been in an operating room, you know, most reasonable people could pick up on how to do a appendix removal. And I mean, it would take training, don't get me wrong, but they could eventually pick it up. Uh-huh. What we pay a doctor to do is to not let the body crash when something with the appendix removal goes wrong.
Amen.
And so that's where The checklist comes because the human brain is so complex in these things we're doing in it. You know, there's a great story about the Boeing 299 back in the 1930s, which now we know today as the Boeing, as the B-17 bomber. Mm-hmm. And this plane was tabbed by newspapers at the time as too much plane for one man to fly. And the reason they tabbed it that is because there was an unprecedented, you can find the story in a book called The Checklist Manifesto by Atul Gawande, fantastic book.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that before. I'm going to have to check it out.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a reference book that you've got to be able to look at. And I love the book and the story in there so much. He says that there was this unprecedented military contract that was going to go out in 1935 to the manufacturer who could build the most promising bomber. And so you had Boeing, you had McDonnell Douglas, and I think it was Lockheed was the third in line. Well, the competition was a non-competition. It was Boeing all the way because of this beautiful, what they called the Flying Fortress. Mm-hmm. And so this thing rolled out on the tarmac, got 300 feet into the air, and fell from the sky, crash burned into flames. And what they found was this was the most complicated plane ever made. It wasn't the pilot was an idiot. It was their most decorated test pilot. But the machine was so complicated, there's not one human on the face of the earth who could fly it.
Wow.
And so that's what's happened. I mean, you think about the technological advances, you know, the whole thing that we've got the IBM supercomputer from 1960 literally in our pocket today.
I know.
You know, things are so complicated
right.
that we've got to go back to the fundamentals of checklist and these canned plans so that we know how to improvise when things go wrong.
Yeah, yeah, so true. Okay, so let's flash forward. So now you finish your college days, and now you're going into the world of work. So let's talk a little bit about some of your first work experiences. What was that like?
So this is where the veer comes in, because I was leaving college going into motorsports. I had interned at the Charlotte Motor Speedway and SMI, their holding corp.
Like
and, I mean, it was too much. We got all access passes. I got to drive.
Whoa.
Jeff Gordon from the front of the track where we were having a big party for previous year's winners back to his camper. I mean, it was – and just like me, him, and his wife in the car. And I was like, you know, I'm 20 years old.
Wow.
And then the next year I got to drive Dale Jarrett just by himself. And so,
that
you know,
like a really cool gig.
Oh my goodness. And we got all access passes. We would act like, you know, we would walk down in the pits and we would like flash our badge like, hey, we've got to go check this over here. And they're like, okay, that sounds good. It was too much fun.
Yeah.
And so I was going to go into motorsports. And because of this faith awakening, in my last year at university, I had a mentor. His name's Adrian Dupree. And Adrian is one of these guys who will spiritually punch you in the face. And tell you things that you just simply don't want to hear. And we all need guys like that. And we're sitting in his, and why do we gravitate to guys? I don't really know, but we do. And so I would meet with him on a regular basis. And he asked me one day, as we were talking about what the next steps were, I said, you know, Adrian, I really do want to grow deeper in my faith. I mean, it's been, you know, 3-4 years now I've been trying to do this. You've been mentoring me, et cetera. But I really want to continue to explore and grow. I was a terrible reader. I was not a very good student, pretty average student, and just kind of mucked my way through the whole experience, both high school and college. And Adrian said, you know, Scott, there's two things you can do. He said, number one, there's a proverb that says, it's not good to have zeal without knowledge, or to be hasty and miss the way. And he said, so I think it's healthy for you to spend a period of time really exploring and studying and learning. And you can do that one or two ways. You can either gather up all the discipline you can muster and self-study, or you can go put yourself in a situation where there are discipline boundaries around you.
Right.
And so I ended up going to theology school in Fort Worth, Texas. And when I got
That's
out there-
That's a big veer.
Yeah, it's huge. Well, it's a big veer in two things. Number one, I didn't grow up in that culture.
Yeah.
And Jeff Gate, they've got their own verbiage, lingo, like secret handshakes, all kind of stuff in this bubble.
You're a total outsider.
Completely. And I'd come from a world of locker rooms with really, really big men, you know, with no clothes on in the shower kind of thing.
I mean, right.
You know, cussing and fighting and doing all this stuff. And
lots
so
of testosterone flowing
tons.
Around.
Tons. Yeah, and so I go into this environment that is so different. And I remember talking to Ashley, my wife, right when we got out there. And the other big veer was she had grown up in the same home her entire life in South Carolina. and I moved her 16 hours away. She's only child, by the way. Moved her 16 hours away, and we started in this tiny little house where we were the only, not lying, we were the only people to speak English fluently on our street in the south part of Fort Worth. And
wow. Okay.
I remember looking at my wife about a month into school, and I go, you know, I need to be here. This is good. The discipline is good, but I cannot be in this environment all day. And so I jumped into business while I was in school.
Okay.
And started into sales, started selling reference materials to CPAs and financial planners to a company that's now been bought up by Thomson Reuters. And it was a fantastic job for about 3 years because I was able to go to school and I was doing phone sales to existing clients. And so I got to start learning the magic of selling. And
actually,
Brian Tracy came in and talked to us live before he was like big Brian Tracy. And it was just, it was really awesome. And so ended up finishing seminary. And while everybody's going to pastor churches and doing all of that, I went to work for Pfizer. And so I left seminary, graduated seminary in 01, ended up going to work for Pfizer. And while I was there, I learned how to do something that I'd never learned how to do before. And that was read. And I don't mean read like work through a book. I mean read for understanding and transformation. And that's what that experience taught me for 3 years, was to really deeply read and get understanding and grow through that reading. And so that launched me into a period when I left seminary at 01 until last year at this time, I was on a complete and almost frustrating adventure to try and figure out how to integrate my faith and my work. Because to me, I had always seen models of people around me where they were separated. Your faith was Sunday morning, your work was Monday through Friday, and then you know, maybe took a nap or mowed the grass on Saturday kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
And it was totally disconnected. Well,
yeah, basically,
we've been doing
your Monday through Friday or Monday through Saturday church is the holy church of consumerism.
Yes.
And then the rest of the week or Sunday is for God.
Yeah. But I couldn't reconcile, Jeff, because
yeah,
I'd be
no,
on
I'm
a
with you. I
it'd
get
be
it.
Wednesday
it's
afternoon at 2:35.
Yeah.
I'd be with a customer and they're talking to me about how their family's imploding. And I'm like, well, under the current model, I mean, this is all subconscious, obviously, but under the current model, I've got to wait till Sunday to get you any help.
Yeah.
But you're in need right now of something transformational that's going to do something significant. You're in need of hope today. And yet, under the paradigm that I'm used to, I've got to wait 3 more days before I can get you any hope. And I've got to situate you in front of somebody who's degreed, you know, et cetera, to be able to get you that hope.
Right.
And that just over time, and I batted back and forth. I went back and forth between for-profit and non-for-profit. For-profit, non-for-profit. Just kept going back, trying to find there's got to be a reconciliation point to this.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been working in Nigeria since 05. And I'll tell you who taught me this more than anybody outside of God's word has taught me about the integration of faith and work are my Muslim friends. And to the horror of my Southern Christian friends, they hate it when I say that. I mean, I live in South Carolina.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not supposed
to
say that.
Sure.
And so to the horror of some of my friends, when I say that I learned more about the integration of faith and work through my Muslim friends, and they allowed me to see God's word differently. And the reason they did is because I'm not talking about the jihadists that we hear all about. That is a minor fraction of the global Muslim population.
Right.
The Muslims I know are incredibly friendly and hospitable.
And it's a daily practice.
That's right.
It's a multi, like there's like 3 prayer times, I think.
There's five per day.
Yeah,
and we had
right.
the privilege about 4 years ago. We were deep in the bush of Nigeria. I mean, like scary in the bush of Nigeria. And we were with a very non-culturally adjusted people group that we were spending the night with out there. I mean, it was surreal, completely surreal. And it was on the night of the breaking the fast of Ramadan. And so we got to be there.
So that's a party.
Well, here's what it turned out to be. The next day was the party. That night was an incredibly solemn final prayer experience that they allowed us to sit and watch. And I thought, and you know what hit me was moms were there, dads were there, and the kids were there. Shoot, even the goats and the cows were there. Everything was there at this thing. They didn't go off to this institution. They didn't go off over here. They walked outside of their houses. They were all together, and they began practicing their devotion. Now, I disagree in a lot of ways from a faith standpoint with my Muslim friends, and they disagree with me. And we've come to be okay with that. Now, I desperately wish that they would follow Jesus. They desperately wish that I would walk with Muhammad. And so we're understanding, we're open about that. Mm-hmm. But to see this integration, and I'll tell you, Jeff, where I saw it is a couple of years ago after that experience, I'd try to do a regular Bible reading plan, and it forces me to walk through the parts of the Bible I just don't really enjoy, you know,
okay.
Numbers and Deuteronomy and stuff like that.
The boring
well,
stuff.
I got to Exodus.
I don't know.
Yeah, I know. I got to Exodus 35, and in fact, it was my daily reading from yesterday, and it changed the way that I see the integration of faith and work. And here's a paraphrase of it, is that God put within a guy named Aholiab, kind of a funny name, but put within him the spirit of skill. He gave him the spirit of skill of craftsmanship.
Right.
And he says that, uses that terminology, skill, I think 5 or 6 times within that chapter and maybe the adjacent chapter. But what it told me, Jeff, is that the skill set that we have, that we've each been given or endowed or whatever, that is a spiritual gift. And it is a spiritual responsibility for us to leverage and use that skill today. Or let me take yesterday. I had a client meeting yesterday. This is actually a husband and wife that work within a professional firm, and meet with them every couple of weeks. Came in, and the wife looks at me, and I've got my coaching agenda to walk with them through some systems and processes and implementation. And she stops and she goes, you know, if it's okay, I wanted to tell you that, I'll use a different name, that Tom hadn't been sleeping at night because he is so overwhelmed at work and I don't know how to help him. And we started kind of peeling back those layers and walking through that. And we spent an hour and a half. We didn't talk the first thing about process till the very end because we found some way to leverage process through the skill that God had given me to be able to help them with a thing that was impacting their family, because it was causing at least disruption within their family. And so that's how you begin to kind of integrate your core conviction and the work all together. You don't have to wait till Sunday to do that. You can do that in the midst of where you're at.
That's amazing, because one of the big themes of this show is the daily practice.
Hmm.
And generally speaking, you know, I'm more the spiritual than the religious type. Yes. I grew up Lutheran in Michigan. So Lutheran in Michigan is like Catholic light, you know, so there's a pastor instead of a priest, you know, but it's very traditional.
Right.
And you know, I don't know when or where, but I guess I do. Still in high school, I started questioning that whole thing, that whole scene. Mm-hmm. And then I've been on that spiritual journey, you know, all the way up until now, obviously. But what I've learned is, for me, you know, I wouldn't even know how to label it, but it's definitely my relationship with, you know, I like to call it God, but some people don't, but I do, is still, you know, it's a daily thing. It's a moment to moment thing. And and it's really a big deal to me every day. I mean, you know, and to me, it's a little less, you know, I veered a little bit away from the more traditional practices, but it doesn't necessarily mean that I don't, you know, agree or disagree, you know, with anybody's faith. I think whatever faith works for you, that's your faith, and do it every day. Mm. I think we can agree on that point, right?
Yeah. And see, that's what's interesting about working with so many different people and from so many different faith backgrounds. I've got actually a couple clients who are just avowed atheists. I mean, they've come out right out, because I'm very upfront.
Yeah.
When I have the privilege of being able to work with somebody, because it's an honor for me. They're the hero of the story. It's an honor for me to be able to work with them. And so I feel like I owe it to them to tell them, you understand that my coaching comes from a worldview, and my worldview is a biblical worldview. And part of my worldview is when Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, I believe that. That's a conviction for me, because I've seen the hope that not only he offers to people, but people have, they've redeemed that coupon, if you will, of hope, and said, you know what, I'm turning this coupon in because I need that. And I've seen people and their lives transformed because of that hope. And what the business does is it gives us a platform and access into people's lives that allows us to extend and to distribute that hope that Jesus offers us. And so it's an incredible, and you're in the invasive part of a person's life. What I've found, because I've been a pastor too. Mm-hmm. And so what I found when I was a pastor is nobody would talk to me the way that they talk to other people out. And so what they would do is they would walk right up to the edge of a cuss word and go, "Ooh, Scott's here. So I better step away from that." And I'm like, "No, no, 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 no. Please, if you don't say it, I will, because it's so uncomfortable. I know where you're going, so just go there."
Yeah.
And let's have the conversation about what that looks like. And so, yeah, it's been, again, going back to your title of vroom vroom veer. I mean, it has been a constant veering of back and forth, testing convictions, doing all that. And I've got a core value in my business that I've got five, but this one in particular tends to kind of raise the most eyebrows, and it is work is faith. That's the core value. And what I mean by that is in Hebrews, which is a book in the New Testament of the Bible, it says faith is a conviction of things that we cannot see.
Right.
All right. So if faith is a conviction of something I cannot see, so let's just take this and kind of backtrack it reasonably and logically. Work is the creation of something that does not exist. You and I are working right now. We're creating a podcast episode that before about, 45 minutes ago did not exist.
Correct.
And so we're creating this. All right. So if I've got a conviction of something I cannot see, a la this podcast or the outcome of this podcast, therefore I go to work to create that which does not exist, this podcast. So when I work, I'm impacting on this faith that I have. And so that's why I think work is an expression of faith, and it is an incredibly, incredibly powerful expression. And I feel like so much of that has been kind of lost and not impacted on. And so frankly,
I'm on a mission
with a lot of my clients. Shoot, that's half the reason I like to get on these podcasts, Jeff, is use this as a stage to say, listen, if you haven't found how to integrate your faith in your work, let's it's out there. This skill you have is a spiritual gift. Let's leverage it.
Amen. I say that all the time, but it seems more apropos today having this Amen, yeah. Brother. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about how you ended up veering into Africa, because that seems fascinating to me. How did that start? When did the idea, when did you have to take that leap of faith to say, yeah, I want to go do whatever you were going to do? I guess it was start a ministry?
Well, we were going to go, I was just going to continue. At the time we got started in Nigeria was 05.
Okay.
And we had just started a church from scratch down in the south part of Fort Worth. And I had a mentor. His name is Bob Roberts, and just a dear friend. He pastors a church up in the north part of Fort Worth. And he had this novel idea back in 1993. Now, so this is way back before I met him. And he looked out at his church congregation one day, and as he tells it, God just hit him with a load. And the load was, hey, moron, you are trying to call out two or three people to go do significant things around the world. You've got a whole room filled of skilled people. Leverage those people and let's mobilize them both locally and globally. And so Bob started flying under this banner called Glocal. And he ripped it off from the business community. But essentially, whatever you do locally, do it globally. And whatever you do globally, do it locally. Man, that resonated with me. And when we started the church, I started really spending time with Bob. And one of the things he said was, hey, Scott, when you start this new church, don't wait till you're 3 years old to get started going globally. Because the argument was among church pastors is, yeah, once we get our tithe based up and once we get to a significant quote. Yes. Then we will, which is common for all of us.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, it's not going to happen if you don't do it.
That's exactly right. And part of his point was, let's bake this into the DNA of the church so they never know any different. And so 2 weeks after we launched the church, I left. I got on a plane and went to Vietnam with Bob to see how he was doing what he was doing. And it was a rallying cry to our little tiny church that, hey, that we're going to go all in, so much so that I'm leaving two weeks after we launch.
Wow.
To go do study.
2 weeks after you start the church.
Yeah. And so I was gone for 2 weeks.
Barely built. Okay.
And so I came back and said, hey, we're going somewhere. Bob challenged me somewhere over the Pacific in seat like 14B. He said, hey, I want to challenge you to really begin praying about working in a challenging place around the world. It's like, ah, dang it. Why?
I don't want to do that. Really? Do I have
to work in Paris, you know, or something like that? But so anyway, we start praying and ended up meeting a guy out of Dallas. He's a Nigerian born guy, business guy in Dallas. We had a 4-hour lunch. He taught me everything he knew about growing up in Nigeria and about the geopolitical background and the Biafran stuff and all of that. And I was just like, wow, this is sounds pretty tough. And ended up coming back to Bob, and Bob's like, that's it, man. And so we got a team of 4 people from our little tiny church. I bet we had 30, 40 people in the church. So it's like 10% of the entire church.
Wow.
I got on a plane and we went over there and we partnered with a local organization and got to work. And over a period of about a decade, we worked in a tiny little rural town called Egbe. And so we started just laboring and really screwing a lot of stuff up. And we did all the stuff that you're not supposed to do, dug wells and, you know, all that stuff. And we just learned through the whole process to the point now where we are literally just weeks away. And I'm not even planning on talking about this, but we are literally weeks away from launching an interesting faith-based Jesus-centered nonprofit called Coaching on Purpose. And here's the strategy. Is we are going to take business professionals. So I'm staring mainly in the face of my clients right now.
Right.
These guys are doing well in business. We've got their business processed, et cetera. And they're looking for something in addition to what they're doing to be significant in.
Yeah, yeah.
So I always tell them all the time, what you're doing now is significant. So don't think it's not. Mm-hmm. So if you want to add something to that, then we can talk about it. And so what I do is I've got a very stringent process for my coaching and how I take people through the vision, mission, values, systems, and processes. Roadmap. And we're going to take that. And for nonprofits and faith-based non-governmentals starting in Nigeria, we're going to begin to work with them. For those who cannot afford coaching as an organization, we're going to begin coaching them in the same exact soup for nuts process I take my clients through. And we're going to do that pro bono. And then what I'm going to do with my clients is they're going to help me coach. And then I'm going to spin them off to do their own coaching with other nonprofits around the world. And
that sounds like a blast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course it is. I mean, you get to see life. I mean, you saw it in the Air Force, Jeff. I mean, when you travel around the world, you just see things differently. And so right now, if you and I were standing on, you know, either side of a table, we would see the table, but I couldn't see what you see.
No, totally. Looking at the same table. I get you. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes.
So yeah, it's been a ride, man.
Yeah, I actually just recently, well, no, not just recently, going on probably a year-ish, give or take, I started doing IT work through a temp agency at Inglewood Unified School District. I don't know if you've ever heard of Inglewood, California. It's not like the upper crust socioeconomic situation. Right, okay. So you get it. And it's funny, even like within... that district, there is sort of like, you know, like a food chain, you know, of where the money flows. And I've seen like examples of, oh, okay, well, this must be Inglewood elite. And then this is not over here. So it's weird because right across the street from the forum is where I've been spending most of my time. It's at an elementary school, and I can't say this for sure, but it's definitely near the bottom of the money food chain and the care food chain of the district. And let me tell you though, those teachers are the most close knit. I mean, obviously you've always got a range of good teacher, bad teacher. Mm-hmm. But there's like, as a group, they've got this like siege mentality. And it's them against the universe, and these kids are going to get the best education, you know, kind of attitude. And just, oh my God. I mean, I had no idea how much one's heart could be broken on a regular basis. You know, in a good way. You know, it's not like, I see some sad things too. But mostly it's just appreciation for just, you know, you show up and, you know, like today... Like one of the teachers that I work with often, you know, she's one of those, you know, IT challenged as most of them are. she's just like, come see me because of X, you know? And whenever she says, come see me because of X, it's never because of X, right?
Right, you right.
So I just know going in that that's not why I'm going. And then she'll go, while you're here. And all it was her little projector thing. The VGA cable was all bad.
I was going to say, let me guess, it was the power button was not pressed?
Something as simple, right? So I swap out the VGA cable and I get a standing ovation from a class of second graders. It's amazing. You know, it's like, and then I'm holding the cable as I'm walking out going, bad cable.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, ha, ha, ha. Yeah, it's a blast. Now, my wife hates it because I'm not making any damn money. So that's the reconciliation, though, because I've got that contribution thing. I feel that.
Yeah.
I know what that feels like. Now I just need to, you know, amp up my money.
right. Which can always be the challenge. And you know, I wonder if God gives us this challenge of, you know, it's interesting when Moses came down from the mountain, first time he came down, he was just miffed because when he came down with these two stone tablets. He had just seen God. I mean, I can't imagine. And when he comes down, he finds out that his brother Aaron has accepted all this gold from all these people because they didn't know where Moses had gone. So they're like, hey, Moses is gone. We don't have somebody to follow, so let's craft a golden calf and let's worship that. And which I don't get it, but whatever. And so he comes down second time, he goes up and he's ticked and he throws the tablets down, breaks them, so he's got to go back up again. Goes back up, comes back down. His face is radiant. It's an amazing story. There are three primary things he talks about when he comes down that mountain. The first one, ironically enough, is rest. And it's the whole idea of Sabbath rest, and you've got to take a day off. That's the very first thing Moses talked about, is he said, hey, I was up on the mountain. God told me to tell you to chill out for a day a week. You know, you work six, the seventh, chill out.
Chill out.
All right? Second thing the third thing. Third thing he talked about was our work. And so he talked about skill and work and all these. The second thing he talked about after rest was contribution. And so you think about this idea of contribution and, yeah, I mean, we all selfishly look at it like, yeah, I can really help these people. And listen, Jesus said the poor are always going to be with us. We're not called to contribute necessarily to help anybody. We're called to contribute because it's pushing us to a completely different level is one of the reasons. And so you're dead on. You know, you talk about this kind of feeling or that experience that you have when you get to contribute something to somebody else. But there's something there, you know, that I don't know how to describe, but yeah, you've hit on it. So no doubt.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, when you could be making, you know, seven figures, you know, I don't know, trying to sell whatever widgets. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just, you know, that's the church of consumerism in football.
Yes. Yeah.
And we've really, you know, even the folks that are on the Sunday, you know, Sunday only situation. Yeah, they're in the same boat, you know, so they're praying to money, you know, all week. And then they show up on Sunday and, you know, say they're sorry. It's sort of like going through the motions. It's not a real spiritual practice almost.
Yeah. And that's really, you mentioned it earlier, you're more spiritual than religious. Like that's a religion. I'm just not, I don't want to go sit and check boxes. That's not moving to me. And frankly, I don't think it's moving to anybody. When we do that, it's quite demeaning, actually, to go do that. Can you imagine if your kids woke up and came and they thought as soon as they walked out of the room, okay, let me think. Okay, go hug dad. All right, walk over, hug dad. All right, box checked.
Right.
It's so demeaning in every way. Right. And so why in the world?
Your heart's not in it. Yeah.
No. Why in the world would we practice faith, you know, like that?
Well, you know, habits are okay and routines are okay, but, you know, doing them for the sake of doing them.
Yes.
Is where you get in trouble.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
That is a great point. Because that is a tough balance is, you know, I've got a habit of daily Bible reading, but at what point does that become checking the box?
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Hey, I did it.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, right. So I'm just spinning my wheels here, kind of thing.
That's right.
Yeah. Amazing. Okay, so now we're already up to now. So let's talk a little bit more about business on purpose.
Yeah, so here was probably one of the biggest fears of my life is for the last 2 years leading up to February of last year, so 13 and 14, I had the distinct privilege of being able to provide leadership full-time for the organization that I mentioned earlier that we went to Nigeria with.
Okay.
And so volunteered with them from, you know, 05 until 13. And about 2011, 12, they asked me to help lead a process to come up with vision, mission, values, systems, and processes for the entire organization. That's kind of how my mind spins and thinks. And so we did that, and we realized quickly that we were going to need an executive director day-to-day to oversee the work. It was about $500,000 annual organization, and we had somewhere around 40 to 42 staff members on the ground in Nigeria. We had about 41 kids that were in our orphanage. I mean, it was a decent sized little outfit.
Yeah.
And so we needed day-to-day oversight from a U.S. perspective to help with the oversight that our Nigerian leadership was providing day-to-day on the ground. And so in 2013, I left Pfizer and took up that opportunity full time.
Wow. And so you were the guy.
Yeah, operationally. And so we had a lot of team members. And so I was just the guy in my, you know, little thing that I could provide coordination, leadership, you know, fundraising help and all that kind of stuff. And so did that. And we just had, Jeff, one of the worst experiences I've ever been through. And that fundamentally, without going into all the details, we had pretty much a hostile organizational takeover by one of the members of the board. And we had two boards, actually, one based in Nigeria because we were a split nonprofit NGO. It's kind of unique in how it's set up. So we had mirroring boards, one in Nigeria made up of Nigerians, one in the U.S. made up of U.S. people.
Okay.
And so we had 9 board members on our U.S. board team. Well, 8 of the 9, there was about 4 months leading up to that was this point of hostility. And we had emergency meetings. I was flying back and forth to Dallas once a month to go have meetings and all this. And it was just really nasty and ugly and really kind of out of my control, which was hard. It was really hard just to go through that because, you may be the leader to some point, but at the end of the day, it's a board-led organization. And I worked for the board. And so February 27th of last year, this takeover had finally been turned into ultimatum. And 8 of the 9 board members resigned on the spot. And they said, we hired you, we're responsible for you. And they were very much quite kind and generous to me while in leadership and even in this situation. And they said, Scott, we've been put in a very, very horrible situation. And we have to make 2 options. Either we cut off funding, but we can't do that because we've got kids in an orphanage, et cetera, or we all resign and we dissolve your position because we're responsible for you and we don't feel that we can leave you under the authority of this one kind of hostile takeover situation. And so I got on a plane February 27th without a job for the first time in my life. Pretty unexpected, actually. I had expected that the hostility would flip completely the other way and that this board would be able to, you know, reconcile everything and we would just move forward. And I had built a plan, you know, kind of moving beyond that and all of that kind of stuff. Board was, you know, they were on board with it. They loved it. But it's just the circumstances came out. And so I came back February 27th, landed here at the Savannah airport about midnight, got home about 12:30, 1 o'clock, came into a quiet house with a wife that I'd been married to, staring down the neck of 17 years of marriage and 3 kids, and I had no safety net whatsoever. <Yikes. laughs> And so,
but you had faith.
By God's grace, we did. And my wife has enormous faith. She's so much farther along than I am in that walk. And so what ended up happening is I had already started the Business on Purpose podcast because I needed an excuse to talk to business owners about how they were integrating their faith in their work because I couldn't figure it out. And so I'd already started the podcast. Well, that was a Friday. On Monday, I called a couple of my buddies who I had been meeting with on a regular basis anyway, and we would meet mastermind and all this, and they were both business owners. And I said, guys, I'm officially in business. The Business on Purpose platform has launched, and I would like for you 2 to be my first clients, and I need you to tell me what you need my help with. And
that's
so
awesome.
built a proposal and started then, and now my business is helping small business owners, primarily under 25 million annual revenue and under 25 employees. Mm-hmm. And I coach them to do a couple things. To number one, help them uncover the things they can't see, because I just stand at a different perspective than they do. And then with that, be able to help them develop a full-scale vision story, mission statement, core value set, and implement that into the culture of the business, not just let it sit on the shelf.
Right.
And then we go through the And then we go through the labor-intensive process of building out the systems and the processes so that these business owners can really sincerely begin to work on their business and become pilots of the ship rather than the practitioners doing everything.
Wow. Yeah, all of that is huge. I mean, it's. Now, I had a question for you.
Yeah.
And this is just kind of a take that I got from a Wayback Machine of Entrepreneur on Fire. Mm. Maybe you heard it, maybe not. But there's an entrepreneur, and I can't remember his name. But he's a quadriplegic.
Oh,
and he lives
yes.
in Mexico.
Yes.
You remember this story,
I do
right?
remember. I don't remember the name either.
Yeah, I don't. Now I'm going to have to. I'll look it up. I'll put it in the show notes, promise. Anyway, he had an amazing story, a very inspiring podcast. I'll link to it in the show notes again. But he said that in his experience, entrepreneurs, whether they know it or not, always come in pairs. Have you ever heard this?
I mean,
it's kind of like a guy like you.
Yeah.
Who is process, right? Process focused.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody with a big idea.
Yeah.
Or a product, you know, a product yes. guy and a process guy is one, you know, oversimplification. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed that? Because
you know
I'm trying
interesting?
To figure out which one I might be.
Yeah. Well, here's what's interesting about it is I'm a disc profile fiend. I'm just a profiling fiend.
Yeah, I remember disc.
In general. And so
I
harp on it. I require all my clients to go through it.
Right.
In fact, in hiring, I will not make hiring recommendations for my clients without them first being profiled because I don't want the weight of that on me.
Mm.
There is way too much we can learn from the profile before we make a hasty decision. And so with that being said, what I have found historically is that business owners tend to fall, if you can just imagine the disc quadrant,
mm-hmm.
Tend to fall somewhere between a CDI in that profile. And again, think about the quadrant. So a D would be the center point for most business owners. And by the way, statistically, there's only about 3% of the population that are true Ds. Everybody says, yeah, I'm a high D. No, they're not.
So what does D stand for again?
A driver. So that's
driver.
Like a
okay.
lion driver.
Like the Leo.
Yes.
I want to be the leader.
That's right.
Everybody
that's right.
follow me.
Only 3% of the population are distinctly
right.
D.
D.
We
okay.
you know, there are other people that have flavors of D within their personality.
Right.
But the overwhelming majority of the population, about 69%, are S's, steady, stable.
Mm.
They're the ones that kind of keep the flow in. And so when you say entrepreneurs come in pairs, here's how I've seen it flesh out. Typically, you have an entrepreneur that is a D or a DC or a DI or maybe an ID or a CD. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those combinations.
Some variation of D.
That's right.
Okay.
And
makes sense. They have
typically,
to want to really bad.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they've right. almost got to be irrational about how they go about it.
Yeah.
And that's what
yeah,
D
yeah,
can
yeah.
be.
It's like
you
that
can't
crazy
overthink it.
Kind of... what is it? Steve Jobs sort of
yes,
fire,
exactly
fire
right.
in the belly.
All right, so
classic fire.
Example.
Yeah.
You talk about entrepreneurs in pairs. Who did Steve Jobs have? Steve Wozniak.
Right.
Who did Bill Gates have? He had Paul Allen.
Right.
You know all. And here's what I found with small business entrepreneurs. They don't have the cash flow to have a pair, a partner.
Mm.
And so what they do is they hire guys like me. There are these Ds, just ideas flowing and going, and they're just, I mean, they got a machine gun, and it's just running out of bullets.
Right.
And they don't even know
ideas,
what to shoot.
Ideas,
at.
Ideas,
yeah.
right, right, right.
And they're crushing it. They're making their income goals. They're doing all this stuff. And at the end of the year, they realize they had a, you know, 2.5% net margin. And they're like, what? I mean, this was the biggest year ever.
Right.
And I walked
so
away with the
they're
least
just
amount
flailing.
Of
money. Yeah.
That's right. And so.
All thrust, no vector. That's what we say in
So what I found the value in coaching and what I can bring is you can hire a guy like me, and I don't bring baseline overhead to a base salary, number one. Number two, I'm here when you need me and gone when you don't, kind of thing.
No benefits.
That's right.
No benefits. And
just number three is
just
I bring. Yeah, that's right. And I bring what you don't have. And that's the ability to be able to not only just think critically, they can think critically. Mm. They just never stop to do it. And so I'm a guy with a whistle in my mouth and a stop sign in my right hand saying, hey, slow down. I want you to think about this. We're going to take 15 minutes and we're going to process this thing out. And then we're going to take a month and implement. And then you'll never have to think about it ever, ever again. And
just
that usually stops
it, basically. Yeah.
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 And so I agree with you. I think they come in pairs, but I think today's entrepreneurs, it's a little bit different because we can do so much with so little now.
That's true.
We can literally bootstrap an organization. And in fact, I just got done with a client saying from here on out for the next 12 months, I don't want you to hire anybody full time. I want you to contract this is a home builder too. I mean, it's not like an online marketer or anything like that.
Right.
This is a traditional brick and mortar home builder. I don't want you to hire another full-time person. I want you to do everything contract work.
Mm-hmm. It's scary.
Because
it's scary.
So much value. Yeah.
Yeah. It's scary because it's like you're losing a measure of control.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very true.
Yeah.
True. But think about all the control you've lost because when you hire
a
person
and
you have them doing, let's say, bookkeeping. And in reality, your bookkeeping only takes about 22 hours a week. But somehow that bookkeeping is magically turned into 40.
Right. Because you hired somebody.
That's right. Or let's say they get done with it in 22 hours and now you feel bad. They feel bad. They want more to do. But you want them just to figure it out, but you don't have time.
Making up stuff for them to do.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, trust me. 20 years in the military. I know all about that crap. Well, hey, Scott, this has been a blast.
I love it.
We hit a lot of good stuff. I could talk to you for a while. Just on the faith alone, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's fun to go down that road and frankly just
it's so hard to talk about it with most people, but it seems like you're really open.
Yeah.
I have a hard time talking with atheists.
Hmm.
No, I shouldn't say that. I talk to them, but I mean, it's just I have such a hard time reconciling that view.
Mm-hmm.
With my own experience, mm-hmm. that I just want to just understand more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I don't. You know, I've since a long time ago, I've given up agreement. That's not all that important to me. Mm-hmm. But if I can get to some understanding, to me, it seems like just like a lot of groupthink. It's like, we think this because it's safe for our job.
Almost. Yeah. Well, and let's admit, I mean, atheism is as much faith as Buddhism, Christianity.
You're right.
It just is.
I know. Yeah. The whole science, you know, it's funny. One of my favorite guests was a former PhD. Well, she's still a PhD, but she's retired from the academic world.
Mm-hmm.
But most of what she talks about was how hard it was to express herself while in academia, just because of...
Wow.
Yeah, I know, right?
Seems like a big paradox, but I get it.
Church.
I mean, I do.
Because it's all about the money, you know? It's like, you can't say that. We won't get funding anymore.
Yeah, we won't get research dollars,
exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Anyway, we're okay. At the end of the day, we're okay. This has been a blast, man. Thank you for spending some time with me and chatting.
Oh man, likewise. I love doing it, and I'm so grateful we've got the technology to be able to do this, and it has been a lot of fun.
All right. Well, you have a great evening, and we'll talk again soon.
That sounds great. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for taking the time to ride along with us on another episode of Vroom Vroom Veer. For podcast info and show notes, be sure to head over to vvveer.com. That's VVVER.com. Man, that's fun to say. And we'll catch up with you next time here on Vroom Vroom Veer.